For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site. It is November the 30th. We are in Parshas Tetzav on page 478. We're up to approximately Pasuk Chaf Vav 26. The last thing we said, we were dealing with the last of the three karbanos that are brought every day of the Miluim. We had the Chatas, which was brought, which we talked about how there were some slight differences between the Chatas that was brought for the Miluim and a regular Chatas. Then we discussed the Ola that was brought, which essentially follows the same rules as a regular Ola. And now we have the Shlamim, which differs from a regular Shlamim in many ways. And we pointed out last time how, in fact, it actually brings together many of the unusual details you find in other unusual shlamims. So here we have, in addition to the animal itself, which is a ram, and the ram itself, there's also the loaves, the 30 loaves that are brought with it. And the fats are waved by Aaron and his sons and Moshe, Moshe acting as the Kohen, and they are waved along with one loaf from each of the types that there are. They're all waved, and then all of that is burned. And that was what we read in Pasuk Chaf Hey, in verse 25, which we'll read one more time tonight. You shall take them, all the things that were waved, from their hands. You shall burn them on the Mizbeach, on the Ola, which means after the Ola. The Ola had already been burned, now you're going to burn these. A pleasant smell before Hashem, meaning it means that Hashem is pleased that we listen to Him. It is a fire offering to Hashem. We said that in a regular shlamim, the chest and also the chest and the shok, which is the right hind leg, go to the kohen. But in this case, as we will see, we already mentioned that the right hind leg was one of the things that was burned. It did not go to the kohen. Moshe is the acting Kohen, and the only thing he's going to get is going to be the chest. So he's only going to get one of the two of the things that are normally given to the Kohen. So let's begin in Chavav 26, and after we've finished going through the rest of the Shlamim, we'll point out all the differences. The other thing we saw with the Shlamim here that we don't see in a regular Shlamim is the placement of both blood and oil on the right hand, in the middle of the right ear, the right thumb, and the right big toe of Moshe, of Aaron and his children. So the pasuk says in Chavav 26, "For lakachtoy sechazeh, you shall take the chest me'el amiluim from the ram that is the miluim karban, which is another word for shlamim, because it's full. It, miluim means complete or full, and the shlamim, because it is shared by the mizbeach, by the kohen, and by the person bringing the carbon, it's considered to be complete and full. So you shall take the chest from the ram of the miluim, asher la'aron, that Aaron has. Ve'naftor so tinufa, you shall wave it lifnei Hashem, before Hashem. Ve'ayalacha limana, and it will be for you as a portion. So you, Moshe, acting as the Kohen, will get the chest. Ve'kidashta es chazeya tinufa, you shall sanctify the chest that was waved. And the right hind leg, which was removed, which was lifted up, asher hunaf v'asher huram, that was waved and was lifted, both of them were waved and lifted, me'el amiluim, from the ram of the miluim, me'asher le'aron or me'asher levanav, that was from Aaron and from his sons. So you shall sanctify these two pieces of the animal, the chest and the right hind leg, in what way are you going to sanctify them? They shall be normally for Aaron and for his sons as a statute forever from the Jewish people. That when they bring a shlamim, the chest and the right hand leg go to Aaron. Kisruma hu, for it is a truma. Truma comes from the word liharim, to lift up, which means to remove. But it's removing it in a praiseworthy manner, to lift it up in a sanctified manner. So you shall, they shall be for Aaron and for his sons as a statute forever from the Jewish people, for it is a truma. Usruma yemeis bnei Yisrael b'zivchei shalmehem, it shall be a truma, something separated or sanctified from the Jews, from their sacrifices of shlamim. Truma samla Hashem, it is a truma to Hashem, it is given to the Kohen, but it is considered to be a truma to Hashem. Now, not to confuse everybody, the word teruma, when we usually see it, is not referring to an animal at all. It's referring to grain, or to olives, or to grapes. That's normally what it's referring to. Teruma is normally given from the five grains, wheat, barley, spelt, oats, and rye. It is given from wine, and it is given from oil, olive oil. And they are given to Aaron, they're given to Aaron or his sons, they're given to Kohanim. So it is an amount that is removed from the pile, removed from whatever it is, and given to the Kohen. A teruma is normally given to the Kohen, and it is prohibited for a non-Kohen to eat it. A zara, a non-Kohen, is not allowed to eat from teruma. Doing so would be to incur the death penalty. It is death by the hands of Hashem, but it is nevertheless the death penalty. So it is for anybody who's not a Kohen, it is not kosher. But it's worse than regular non-kosher food. Regular non-kosher food is just a regular law, a regular prohibition, which is punishable with lashes. But the regular teruma has an elevated status, and if a zara non-Kohen eats it, then it is punishable with death. That's normally what the word teruma means. In this context, it also means something given to the Kohen, but it is not the typical way the word teruma is used. Here it is referring to parts of the animal, which are of the sacrifice, which are given to the Kohen. In this, when we discuss the shlamim later on in Parshios Vayikra and Tzav, we'll discuss whether these parts of the animal, the chest and the right hind leg that go to the Kohen, whether a zar is allowed to eat them or not, a non-Kohen is allowed to eat them or not. We'll discuss them when we get to those, to the discussion of that over in that case over there. Here, there's no question the zar, the non-Kohen, couldn't eat it, because in this case, the zar, the non-Kohen, wasn't even allowed to eat the rest of the animal, because the rest of the animal was owned by Aaron and his sons, and they are becoming Kohanim, and we'll see presently that the rest of the animal was kudshim, was the type of sacrifice that a non-Kohen could not eat. So in this case, certainly the portions that went to the Kohen could not be eaten by a non-Kohen. Yeah.
When you keep talking about the right hind leg, I keep thinking of the gid hanasha.
Part of the animal is the gid is the hip.
Oh,
now,
okay.
We don't eat the hindquarters of an animal at all. So the entire hindquarters of an animal is sold to a non-Jewish slaughterhouse. That's not because the entire hindquarters are prohibited. That is because it is complicated to remove the gid hanasha, which is prohibited. And in America, it is not financially viable to work on removing it. There just isn't a big enough market to go through the labor-intensive process of removing it so that we can have In Eretz Israel, you can get it.
Is that by Sfaradim?
No, anybody can. And then, as long as it's removed properly, it can be eaten by anybody, but it has to be done properly. In America, the way the slaughterhouses work is they always are connected in some way, either directly connected or financially connected to a non-kosher slaughterhouse. Because what do you do with any animal that's slaughtered improperly? It becomes a trefa, it becomes an avela. What do you do with it? So it's a significant loss of money. So you have some kind of arrangement with a non-kosher slaughterhouse, which is where it goes. So by the same token, the hindquarters of the animal are given as well. So that's the way it typically works in America. But that here we're not talking about the Gid HaNasha. The Gid HaNasha would have been removed separately. So now this is, we're not done the discussion of Aaron and his sons with the Miluim, but let's pause here to understand a regular Shlamim and this Shlamim. There's many differences between this Shlamim and a regular Shlamim. And as I mentioned to you before, what's happening with the Miluim is that it's not that things are being done in a way that are completely novel. It's that different rules are being taken from different types of karbanos and applied to this karban. So that a regular shlamim that is brought, anybody can bring a regular shlamim and anybody can do it for whatever reason they wish. You just feel like bringing a karban, you can bring a shlamim. You don't need a reason to bring a shlamim. A shlamim would be brought to the Beis HaMikdash. It would be slaughtered. The blood would be thrown on the Mizbeach, on the altar, two applications which are four, the corners of the Mizbeach, and the various fats would be burned on the altar. The chest and the right hind leg would go to the Kohen, and the rest of the animal would be eaten by the Bailim, by the owner of the animal, and he could invite whoever he wished to join with him in that meal. That meat does not have to be eaten by a Kohen, it can be eaten by non-Kohanim. And anybody who is not Tameh, who is not impure, anybody who is Tar, who is pure, could eat from the Karban Shlamim. It has to be eaten somewhere in Yerushalayim, in the Old City. How much time do you normally have to eat a Shlamim? You have the day it is slaughtered, that night and the following day, all the way until sunset of the following day. So you have, at most, 2 days and one night to eat of the shlamim. Anything left over after that point would become nosar, left over, and would have to be burned. That's a typical shlamim.
Does it have to be a ram?
It does not have to be a ram. No, it can be a ram, it could be a goat, and it can be a cow.
What about a deer?
Deer can never be a carbon. No. A deer is a chaya. Can't be. Not a cow, a bull, I'm sorry. A deer is a chaya,
yeah.
A chaya, which is a wild animal, can never be a carbon. A shlamim can be male or female. I'm sorry, I was just thinking through my head as I was talking. Yeah, it can be male or female.
Same with the goat and the sheep?
Yeah, it can be a male or female, goat, sheep, or a cow. That would be for a shlamim. That's not true with other types of karbanos. An ola must be male, a chatas must be female. But a shlamim is either male or female. Yeah.
During this inauguration and also during the regular times, when something is given where the Kohen has to eat it, can the Kohen's family also?
So those types of karbanos that only the Kohen is allowed to eat from, which is what are called kudshei kudshim. That's the higher level of sanctified food, of karban. That can only be eaten by the Kohen himself, not by his family. Whereas kudshim kalim, which is the less stringent type of karban, which is what a shlamim normally is, could be eaten by anyone who is tahar. Anybody who's pure. Okay. So this is a regular shlamim is, but thank you for pointing that out, is kudshim kalim, is the lower level of kudshim, could be eaten by anybody as long as the person is pure, and it's eaten in Yerushalayim, in the Old City. You have 2 days and one night to eat it. It could be a male or female, goat, sheep, or a cow, and it is, there's only two parts that are given to the Kohen and some parts that are burned on the altar. That's a regular shlamim. Now, in this case, We're going to try to list all the differences, as many as I can think of as we go through. So in this case, you have, let's take it incrementally. First of all, this shlamim is considered kadshim, kadshe kadshim. It's the higher level of sacrifice, in which case only the kohanim could eat it, which Aaron and his sons are kind of half kohen, half not. They're on their way to becoming kohanim. They're the only ones who could eat it. In addition, it cannot be eaten in all of the city of Yerushalayim. It has to be eaten in the courtyard of the Beis HaMikdash, which means that since they were in the wilderness, they were in the Midbar, it had to be eaten in the courtyard of the Mishkan. That's where it had to be eaten. They only had the day it was offered and that night to eat it. They could not eat it for 2 days and one night, only for that day and the following night. That's it. And they had to finish it by then. The only part that went to Moshe, who was the stand-in Kohen, was the chest, not the right hind leg. And in a completely unusual manner, the right hind leg was burned along with all the other fats that were burned on the altar. That's a complete departure from a regular shlamim.
Are these laws still?
What's that?
Are these laws still?
No, because this was only relevant to the time they had the miluim, when they inaugurated the Kohanim. There are loaves brought with the shlamim. That is something which we do find with a nazir. We do find that he brings loaves. And we do find it with a karban todo, with a Thanksgiving offering. But in a typical shlamim, you don't have any loaves. Here you have loaves similar to what you find with a nazir and what you find with a todo, with a Thanksgiving offering. The exact type of loaves are slightly different, but you do have loaves. Like those cases of the Thanksgiving offering, the todo, and the nazir, you take one loaf out of ten, one out of each type. You take one out of ten. And you do something different with the 1 out of 10, except that over here, you don't do what you do over there. In the other cases, you take 1 out of 10 and you give them to the Kohen, while the owner eats the other 9. In this case, 1 out of 10 are burned, and Aaron and his sons ate the other 9. So the 1 out of 10 here are being treated like the right hind leg, as if there's no Kohen around. Even though Moshe is the acting Kohen, the only thing he's going to eat as an acting Kohen is the chest. He will not eat the right hind leg. He will not eat 1 out of every 10 loaf. Instead, those 1 out of every 10 loaves and the right hind leg are going to be burned as if there was no coin around at all. So Moshe is kind of straddling the fence here. Sometimes he's given the privilege of coin, sometimes not. In addition to that, we find an application of blood and oil on Aaron and his sons, on their middle of their ear, right on their right thumb, and on their right toe. This we don't find in a regular shlamim. The only time we find this elsewhere is with someone who has tzara'as, who is healing from having had tzara'as. We find the application similar to this. Yeah, that it is only the blood that is applied, not the oil. That is my mistake. With the mitzora, with the person that's saras, you apply both blood and oil. Here, you only apply the blood. One other thing that is done differently here that I can think of is that the blood and the oil is sprinkled on Aaron and on his sons. And that you don't find in a regular shlamim, but as we mentioned last time, you do find that at the time of Matan Torah, when we got the Torah on Har Sinai, there was blood that was sprinkled on the Jewish people before we got the Torah, after the Karbanos were offered.
On all those million people,
So we have here the bringing together of many elements that we find in other places. We find Nazir, Karban Todah, Tzara'as, giving of the Torah. We find all those things kind of coming together in this shlamim. This shlamim is almost like a super shlamim. Shlamim means complete or full, where you have elements that go to the kohen, elements that go to the mizbeach, elements that go to the owner. And here you have all of that, plus you also have elements that are reminiscent of other services that aren't normally associated with a regular shlamim. And all of that is coming together in this shlamim. Plus, it's being sanctified at a higher level, which means you have less time to eat it, fewer people can eat it, and you are more limited where you can eat it. And there are certain parts that are being treated as if there is no one who can deal with them. There is no Kohen who can eat them, and therefore they are burned. And that would be the loaves and the right hind leg. So that's what's going on here with this shlamim, which is a departure from all other karbanos that we find in the Torah. Yeah.
So would it be a way of looking at it to say that instead of there being no Kohen, Hashem himself is the Kohen, Moshe is an interim or deputy Kohen that gets some but not all the privileges of Kohen, but the actual Kohen here is Hashem himself is receiving income from him.
Okay, that's an interesting idea, and you may be right. The way to say that would be to point out correctly that these are all the parts that are being burned on the altar. They're not being burned outside the camp as if, well, they're pustle, they're invalid, so we can't do anything with it. Okay, burn them outside the camp. The way I was saying it, you would expect them to get burned outside the camp. But the way Dr. Faria is saying it, it's in fact they're being burned on the altar, which means they're becoming the portion of the altar.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're suggesting that the altar, or so to speak, Hashem becomes the Kohen for the time being, or is the Kohen for the time being, until that office is given over to Aaron and his sons. Moshe, though, is given some privilege of Kohen in that he's eating of the chest of the animal. So it's a nice explanation. Very good.
Does he have to finish the whole chest?
Yeah, they all had to finish the parts they ate. Anything that wasn't finished by the next morning would have to be burned. Yeah. And burned not on the altar, burned outside the camp, because it's invalid. It got left over. Okay, so we're getting a little ahead of ourselves. We're going to read some of these things now. So, starting with Pasuk Chav Tes 29. Now remember, all of this was done in order to sanctify Aaron and his sons and to sanctify their clothing. The oil was poured on them and their clothing. The blood was sprinkled on them and their clothing. So the pasuk says, the verse says, "Uvigdei haKodesh asher liAaron, the sanctified clothing that Aaron had, yu levanav acharav, should be to his sons after him, lemashchav vahem, to anoint them with them." How do they translate that? To
become inaugurated.
Inaugurated through them, right? Ulamalevam es yadam, and to fill their hands with them. They say, yeah.
Become
they say
elevated, and the second one's inaugurated.
Right.
Yeah. Sorry.
Right. So to become elevated and to inaugurate.
But that's not really what it says here.
Yeah. So the word mashcha, which means to anoint, also is used to mean to elevate. The Gemara, for example, says that when it says that a karban is limashcha, which it says here and it says in other places as well, teaches us that the way that they eat the karban should be in an elevated manner, because it's an elevated thing, because it says mashcha. Similarly, filling the hands is another way of saying to inaugurate, to give someone a position. You fill their hands with the position. So the clothing that Aaron had would go to his children. Now, the clothing that Aaron had, Aaron was the Kohen Gadol. So going to his children implies that his children become the Kohanim Gedolim. And we do derive from here that if the Kohen Gadol has a son who is worthy of becoming the Kohen Gadol in his stead, then he is first in line to become the Kohen Gadol. Meaning that you don't hold, I don't want to call it an election, but you don't look for the best candidate. If the Kohen Gadol has a son who is appropriate to be the Kohen Gadol, even if he's not the best candidate, but he is an appropriate candidate, then he's first in line. This rule you find throughout the Torah when it comes to positions, which brings up the whole issue of nepotism. But the Torah, throughout the Torah and in the Gemara, we find that when a person has a position, the default is that it passes to his son, provided that his son is worthy of the position. Not that he's the most worthy, but he's worthy. As long as he meets the criteria that are necessary, he's over the threshold of being competent and valid for the position, then he is automatically first in line, even if there are other candidates who are actually more qualified. That doesn't matter as far as the Torah and the Gemara's hierarchy is concerned when it comes to the passing on of positions to the next generation. That is true of Kohen Gadol, and it is true in any type of Srara, any type of position that you'll find in the Torah, and the Gemara continues with that same approach. Today it doesn't always work that way, but that is certainly what you find in the Torah. So Aaron's sons, one of them anyway, one at a time, you can't have more than one Kohen Gadol at a time, are the first in line to become the Kohen Gadol. You also see from here that the wearing of the clothing is a way of inaugurating the next Kohen Gadol. It is not necessary to pour oil on his head as was done with Aaron, but it could be done by simply putting on the 8 garments. That is the initiation, that's the inauguration of the new Kohen Gadol after Aaron.
Washed all those clothes.
Yeah, they had Kohanim who were designated to do that. People, the Mishnayos speak about how there was a particular Kohen who was in charge of the clothing. So he was in charge not only of cleaning them, but also in charge of making sure that new ones were made as new Kohanim entered the Kohanate, I guess you call it. To make sure there were different sizes available, you know, as people grew, you know, they had to have.
How often were they doing sacrifices that required blood and oil to be
every?
On them?
Oh no, that was unusual, but they got blood on their clothing every day. I mean, the whole, you know, sacrifices were, there's blood all over. I mean, it's a regular occurrence.
The karmikite oil also.
Yeah, that wasn't as messy. Yeah. But yeah.
The Kohen Gadol, if his clothing would be worn by his successor, what if his sons were all very obese or something and couldn't wear?
Yeah.
Mean that that son would not be suitable to be the Kohen?
No, it didn't have to be the same clothing that he wore. It just means the 8 garments that are worn by the Kohen Gadol,
but new garments. Could be
new garments, yeah. If they didn't fit, then new garments, yeah.
Oh, but those garments didn't have to be inaugurated.
Right, exactly. That's right. Okay, now, the next pasuk, Lamed, verse 30, Shivas yamim yovasham kohen tachtavi banav, 7 days the Kohen will wear them in his stead, meaning in Aaron's stead, from his sons. When he comes to the Oel Moed, the tent of meeting, which is the tabernacle, to serve in the Kodesh, in the holy place. So by wearing the clothing for 7 days, that's the inaugural process. The Gemara tells us, not based on this pasuk, but actually based on a pasuk later on, which sensibly we're going to get there, and hopefully I'll remember to talk about it then, but it's going to be a little while to get there. It's not until we get to Parshas Tzav. So I want to mention it now. The Gemara says that this 7-day initiation process, which we find right over here with the Miluim, is repeated in 2 other places involving Kohanim. One is that 7 days before Yom Kippur, the Kohen Gadol is sequestered in a room near the base, or actually right off the Beis HaMikdash, and he prepares for Yom Kippur during those 7 days. He's not quarantined, he's just sequestered. So other people are coming in, but he has to remain there. And he practices and studies in preparation for what he's going to have to do on Yom Kippur. That's a 7-day waiting period before Yom Kippur to become ready to do the avodah, the service properly. The other time the Gemara says is before processing a new para aduma, a new red heifer, before processing it. When I say processing, I don't mean the taking of the ashes and sprinkling on a person who is tamei meis, who is impure from coming in contact with a dead body, in order to purify the person. That there's no preparation necessary. But if for a brand new para aduma, new red heifer, which has to be slaughtered and then burned and the ashes gathered and all that, that requires a 7-day preparation process prior to the processing of the para aduma. The Gemara compares these three cases when you need a 7-day initiation. That of the miluim over here, that of the kohen before Yom Kippur, and that of the processing of a new para aduma, of a new red heifer. There was another place where there was a 7-day waiting period, which you might remember back in Parshas Mishpatim. And that is that Moshe Rabbeinu, before entering into the clouds on top of Har Sinai to get the Torah, there was a 7-day waiting period before he was able to go in to get the Torah. There was a difference of opinion whether there was 7 days before hearing the Aseres HaDibros, the 7 days prior to the Ten Commandments, or even after the Ten Commandments. You know, the Moshe was up there for 40 days, whether the first 7 were spent preparing to enter into the cloud where he would actually be given the rest of the Torah from Hashem. But there you also find a 7-day preparation process. So it seems the Torah sees a week, the length of time of a week, as being the time frame necessary to prepare. When I say prepare, I mean to put oneself in the proper frame of mind to be able to do something of great significance, a 7-day period. Question?
Could you add the period associated with the Metzorah?
Well, the Metzorah is Tamei.
Right, but he's going from Tamei to Tahor. These other situations are, say, Tahor to Kadosh. So it's a step lower.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's nevertheless sort of an inauguration back into normal society.
Yeah,
back.
Yeah, it's true that the Metzorah goes through a two. It's
2-7-day.
Yeah, he's Tamei, and then however long it takes to become Tar. But then when he's going Tar, he goes through one process, then there's 7 days and another process. So it's true that 7 days between the two things that he has to do in order to become Tar. So you could apply it. Just the difference is that.
You're starting from a much lower level.
Right.
I mean, we waited for Miriam 7 days. Right,
right. Right. Yeah, but that was unusual. Most of the time, Saras is longer than that.
Okay.
She was 7 days. Most of the Saras cases go for more than 7 days.
Yeah. Is 7 days related maybe because Shabbos? Because 7 days.
Well, it's a week long. It seems that the week.
The Kodesh, the finality of it, yeah.
I guess so, but it seems like once you've gone through a full week and you've gone through the gamut of days, and now you're ready.
Mm-hmm.
A 7-day waiting period. The Torah continues. Pasuk.
Lamanov
31. Getting back to the sacrifices. Veis Ela Miluim Tikach. You shall take the ram of the Miluim, this Shlamim. Uvishaltaz Pisaro B'makom Kadosh. You shall cook its meat in a holy place. It means to roast. It doesn't mean to cook. It doesn't mean to boil. It means to roast the meat in a sanctified place, which means it had to be done in the courtyard of the Mishkan of the Tabernacle. V'achal Aharon uvanav es besar ha'ayol, and Aaron and his sons will eat the meat of the ram, v'et ha'lechem asher basol, and the remaining loaves that were in the basket, 9 of every 10 type, there were 30 total, so now there are 27 left. They shall eat it Pesach HaMoed at the entrance to the Mishkan, to the tabernacle, which means in the courtyard. V'achlu osam asher kupar bahem, those who have been atoned for through them shall eat them. Aaron and his sons are being atoned for in order for them to be assume the position of Kohen. They are being atoned for, so they shall eat them. Lemaleis yadam, again, literally means to fill their hands, which means to inaugurate them. Likadesh osam, to sanctify them. And here we have the commandment, Bizar lo yochal, a non-Kohen is not allowed to eat them, ki kodeshem, for they are sanctified. So here you see that it has the law of kodshei kodshim, the higher level of sanctity, where a non-Kohen is not allowed to eat from these karbanos, from these sacrifices. And if any of the meat of the miluim and any of the bread, or I shouldn't say bread, the loaves, will be left over till the morning, you shall burn the leftovers in fire. Lo ye achel, they shall not be eaten, ki kodeshu, for they are sanctified. If they are left over, they are not allowed to be eaten. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech haolam
she'akol nivra.
V'asisa le'aron u'levonav kacha, you shall do to Aaron and his sons in this manner, k'chol asher tzivisi osacha, like everything I've commanded you, shivas yamim t'malei yadam, 7 days, you shall fill their hands, which means you shall inaugurate them. U'fachatos ta'aseh la'yom ala kippurim, so now each day you shall make or do or process a bull of a chatas. That was the first of the 3 sacrifices. This should be done each day. Al HaKippurim. Just like the word Yom Kippur, Yom Kippurim. On the atonement. V'chiteisa al HaMizbeach. And you shall purify the altar. V'chaparcha alav, as you atone for it. Umashachtahu so v'kadesho, and you shall anoint it to sanctify it when you put the oil on it. So the Torah here goes back to the case of the first karban to tell us that's also done every day of the 7 days. Shivas yamim techaper al mizbeach, 7 days you shall atone on the mizbeach. V'kidashto so, and you shall sanctify it. V'ayah mizbeach kodesh kadashim, the mizbeach, the altar, shall be kodesh kadashim, holy of holies. What does that remind you of? The holy of holies itself. Okay, well, we're going to talk about this. Kol hanogea b'mizbeach yikdash, anything that touches the altar shall become sanctified. This last pasuk, this last verse, the mizbeach is considered kodesh kadashim. Now, we know that the inner sanctuary of the Mishkan and of the Beis HaMikdash was called the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of the Holies. That's where the Aron, the Ark, is. That's where the Kohen Gadol is only allowed to go one time a year on Yom Kippur. The top of the altar is now also being referred to as Kodesh HaKadoshim, Holy of Holies. Now, that's not a place that was located in the inner sanctuary. This was located in the courtyard of the Mishkan. It wasn't inside. And any Kohen who was pure was able to walk up on top of the Mizbeach. It's not considered a place that's off limits to everybody. Yet, it does get the title Kodesh Kadashim, Holy of Holies. Clearly, it's meant to be a little different than what the Holy of Holies means when we talk about the inner sanctuary of the Mishkan, but there is some connection between the top of the Mizbeach and the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the inner sanctuary of the Beis HaMikdash of the Mishkan. We know, for example, we know that the Temple Mount, the Har HaBayis, today we know that there is a mosque over there, the Dome of the Rock. That mosque went through a period of time during the Crusades where it was a church.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a specific place that they've designated as a place to put their edifice unfortunately, of their false worship. the question is, what's supposed to be there? It apparently it's a holy place, meaning that we know the whole area back there is holy, but apparently specifically that spot is a holy place. What was supposed to be there? So most people presume it is the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies, that's supposed to be there. Not everyone agrees to that. Some say that's the place of the Mizbeach, of the altar. Because the altar also was a very holy place, and the altar is also called Kodesh HaKadoshim. So what exactly do they have there? Assuming they have the right spot of something, which is not guaranteed, but assuming they do, which something is it? Is it the Kodesh HaKadosh, the Holy of Holies, the inner sanctuary of where the Beis HaMikdash, or is it where the Mizbeach was? We'll find out, hopefully, soon. The top of the altar is where most of the service took place. Most of the avodah took place on top of the altar, not the slaughtering, but the burning of the fats and limbs took place on top of the altar.
And
the sprinkling of the blood. The sprinkling of the blood wasn't on the top, usually it was on the sides. But on top of the altar was the burning of the fats and the limbs. The altar, really, as was pointed out before, is the way that portions of the carbon are given to Hashem. They're burned on the altar. So where the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the inner sanctuary, represents the place where it is the most sanctified place, in that people can't go there normally. Only the holiest man of the Jewish people on the holiest day of the year could go in there. Otherwise not. And even when he does, he has to go in with very specific instructions of what he's allowed to do when he's in there, and what he must do, what he's instructed to do when he's in there. And that's where the Aron, that's where the altar is, with the Aseres HaDibros, with the Luchos, with the two tablets. The top of the altar, the top of the Mizbeach, is the place where the things that are being given to Hashem are consumed, are burned. So that, in a certain sense, the top of the altar, or perhaps we'll say the fire on top of the altar, also has an element of Kodesh HaKadoshim. That Hashem is represented on top of the altar, just as He's represented in the inner sanctuary. You know that when the Jews traveled in the Midbar, in the wilderness, so in Parashas Bamidbar, we will learn, Mirtz Hashem, we'll learn then that they took all the various utensils, they wrapped them up, and they traveled when the Levim carried it. But the law is, as we mentioned when we learned about the Mizbeach, you're not allowed to extinguish the fire on the Mizbeach. That's a prohibition. You're not allowed to extinguish it. So they would take a metal pan or something, right? They would cover it, and it would remain there, and it would not burn anything through, and it would not become extinguished from the lack of oxygen. It would just be there, and it would be like the Gemara says, the Gemara likens it to a crouching lion. It's just been temporarily capped. The lion is crouching underneath, and when they encamped and they took the Mizbeach out and they put it down, they took off the covering and the fire sprang up again. The Mizbeach is called Ariel, which also is a reference to lion. Right. So the top of the Mizbeach has elements about it that are also Kodesh Kadoshim, our Holy of Holies. Not the same type of Holy of Holies. It doesn't prohibit someone who's not a Kohen Gadol from going up there. But it has elements of Kodesh Kadoshim. The Torah here tells us a very important aspect of in what regard is it Kodesh Kodashim? And follow this very carefully, because this is critical to understanding what it means that it's Kodesh Kodashim, and in contrast to Kodesh Kodashim of the inner sanctuary. It's a little confusing because we always refer to the inner sanctuary as the Kodesh HaKodashim. It says here, whatever touches the Mizbeach will become sanctified. What does that mean? So what it means is the following. There are all kinds of rules regarding sacrifices. All kinds of rules. That only certain types of animals are permitted to be used as sacrifices. They have to be from the bovine family, the ovine family, but they can't be chaya. They can't be deer, even though deer are kosher, but they can't be used as a carbon. The animal has to have no blemish. The animal also can't have had things done to it which would invalidate it from being used as a carbon. So, for example, if the animal was worshipped by a non-Jew as an avodah zarah, as an idolatry, it would become invalid. If the animal were, I guess the word you'd say is molested, if someone committed bestiality with the animal becomes invalid to be used as a carbon. So the animal has certain rules about it. An animal also, when it is slaughtered, has to be slaughtered properly in order for it to be a good carbon. Not only properly, like when we slaughter animals today to make it kosher, which is that slaughtering, the technical process of the slaughtering has been done right, cut in the right place, with the right type of knife, and the right motion, etc. All these rules. But in addition to that, there's also the fact that the Kohen has to be thinking the right things as he slaughters it. He has to be thinking about what type of carbon it is. He has to have it correctly, which type of carbon it is. He has to be thinking about the fact that it is going to be eaten at a certain time and in a certain place. If he has in mind to eat it in the wrong time or the wrong place, that can also invalidate the carbon. We will learn all these laws. Please God, only get to Sefer Vayikra. But there are a lot of laws. An animal that was essentially a kosher carbon, but became invalid in the process of the Kohen taking slaughtering it, etc., it really should not be burned on top of the Mizbeach. It should be removed from the Beis HaMikdash and burned outside the Beis HaMikdash. But if it was placed on top of the altar, and then they realized they made a mistake, it shouldn't have been put up there. Kol hanogea b'mizbeach yikdash, anything that touches the altar becomes sanctified. Even though it's technically an invalid carbon, and the one who brought it has to bring another one, but once the animal was placed on top of the altar, it remains on top of the altar. It is burned on top of the altar. It is not removed and burned outside the camp, where it should have been burned outside the camp, but once it gets placed on top of the altar is collate. It absorbs that carbon, that animal, and it gets burned on top of the Mizbeach. The word collate, what does that remind you of?
Collation?
Well, that's in English, but what about in Hebrew?
Kol, voice.
Okay.
All.
How about ear? City?
Oh, your miklat.
Mir miklat, same word. The city of refuge. It's the same word. To be collate. It means to absorb. And the Mizbeach grabs hold of whatever gets put on top of there and keeps it. Now, if the animal was inherently invalid, then even putting it on top of the Mizbeach wouldn't help. So if the animal, let's say, were worshipped and then put on top of the Mizbeach, it would still get removed from the Mizbeach and burned outside the camp. But if it became invalid in the process of the carbon, then even though it should have been burned, if it is put on top of the Mizbeach, it is now burned on the Mizbeach rather than outside the camp. So we see here an incredible contrast between the Kodesh HaKadoshim of the top of the Mizbeach and the Kodesh HaKadoshim of the inner sanctuary. What happens if the Kohen Gadol goes into the inner sanctuary on Yom Kippur and does not perform the service according to the way he should, what happens?
Dies.
Okay, so he dies. And they, okay, so now, although it is true that they did tie a string around his, they tied a string around his leg, just in case he died inside, they would pull him out. He didn't always die in the Kodesh HaKadosh, if he did it wrong. What the Gemara actually says is he died within the year. He wouldn't live out the year if he performed the service incorrectly. But be that as it may, entering the Kodesh HaKadoshim means a certain expectation of perfection, a certain expectation of performance that is up to the standards of the Kodesh HaKadoshim. When you go in there, and none of us can ever go in there, we're not Kohanim Gedolim, when you go in there, there is an expectation of perfection. And that's why you need to practice before you go in, make sure you do it right, and then enter inside to the Kodesh HaKadoshim. The Mizbeach, there's also an expectation of perfection. But whereas you find with the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies, the sanctuary, when that perfection is not met, so the result is tragedy. When the perfection is not met on top of the Mizbeach, which is also Kodesh HaKadoshim, the result is overlooking. The result is, all right, it's here already, we're going to keep it. We're not throwing it out. It's the opposite. It's literally the opposite effect. And they're both called Kodesh HaKadoshim. They're both called Holy of Holies. So Holy of Holies is meant to strike fear. I mean, it's a Holy of Holies. Got to act perfectly. And you do. Kohen Gadol was great trepidation going into the Holy of Holies on Yom Kippur. But the top of the Mizbeach is also Kodesh HaKadoshim, and it's almost diametrically opposed. Over there, you got to do it right. If it's not right, okay, it's all right. We'll keep it. This brings out the dual aspect of our relationship with Hashem, with our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Torah tells us, we'll learn about it, Mitzvah Hashem, also in Sefer Vayikra, that if we keep the Torah properly, we do everything that we're supposed to do, then Hashem says, I will be metayel with you in Gan Eden. Metayel, you know what a teyul is? A teyul means
a stroll.
I'll be metayel with you. I'll stroll with you.
Which kind of Kodesh
is it referring to? Hold on. He says, I'll stroll with you in Gan Eden, Hashem says. We'll have a relationship in which we'll walk together in Gan Eden. Walk together, like as if we're buddies. Then the Gemara says, Yachol, you might think you won't fear me. So the Torah says, V'yareisa, you will fear Hashem. He'll stroll with us, but we'll still have a fear of Hashem like we're supposed to. There's this dual aspect of the relationship. We have to fear Hashem. That is, Yiras Hashem is a laudable level which we should strive for, to reach a point where we are in awe of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, where our appreciation of what Hashem is so intense that we are simply in awe of the presence of Hashem. Nevertheless, if we behave properly, we are still able to attain a position where Hashem says, I'll stroll with you. There's a closeness within that sense of awe, of fear that we have of Hashem. There still is a closeness. If you want to call it Ahava and Yira, love and fear, you want to call it that, you can call it that if you want. The Mizbeach represents kapara, atonement. The Mizbeach represents that aspect of our relationship with Hashem that Hashem says, I want a relationship with you. I'm looking for ways of tipping the scales in your favor. I'm not interested in punishment. I'm not interested in pushing you away. I am intensely interested in you becoming close to me and my bringing you close. And the Mizbeach itself represents it within the laws of the Mizbeach. Something gets put on the Mizbeach that shouldn't have been there. The Mizbeach overlooks the blemish. Okay, fine. It shouldn't have been here. You shouldn't have sinned, but you did. Okay, we're moving forward. You're going to do teshuva. We're moving on. It's okay. We'll move on. But we can't be cavalier about it. It's not like, well, now God, just forget about it, right? It's not like that. There's a fear. There's an awe. There's a seriousness. There's a kovod rosh about our relationship with Hashem. That is represented by the Kodesh HaKadoshim, by the inner sanctuary, the Holy of Holies, which no one goes except on Yom Kippur, and only the Kohen Gadol, and only for a very specific purpose. These two things make up Kodesh Kadoshim, Holy of Holies. They're both elements of what it means, Holy of Holies.
What exactly is atonement?
It's a good question. We have Mechila, which is forgiveness, and we have Kapara, which is atonement, which is a good question. The truth is, I intended to talk about that a little bit over here as well.
Maybe next.
Yeah, so maybe we will hold off. I just can you make a note please to remind me about that? It's atonement and the Mizbeach. The thing to remember is to go back to Parshas Bereishis. Okay? Yeah.
Can not only be the duality of fear for Hashem Ahav and Yireh, but also Midas Hadin, Midas Harachem?
Yes, yeah, same idea. Same thing. Both elements are expressed over here.
I think it's interesting that the sacrifice gets absorbed, even if it's become tummy, and one of the ways in which it would have become tummy is if the Kohen was not thinking the proper thoughts, if he didn't have the right kavana. So Hashem has arranged that through these rules, just as we have a sin offering that gets put in the same place as an olah, so people don't know, you know, who's bringing the sin offering and olah. People don't know, because the sacrifice is lying there one way or the other, whether it was really a proper sacrifice. I mean, the only way of knowing is if you actually track down who's got to make another sacrifice in its place. But it's a merciful way of sparing the feelings of the Kohen.
It's true, except that if it didn't get on top of the Mizbeach, we would take it out of the Mishkan and burn it. It's only if it ended up on top of the Mizbeach.
If we had recognized.
Right, right. This is only after the fact. If a mistake was made and it was put on top of the Mizbeach, then it just stays. So I don't think that we can say that this is purely to protect somebody's...
Would the mistake have been made by a Kohen in the process?
Yeah.
So
it would
have been a Kohen's mistake.
But the mistake would be to put it on the Mizbeach, not the mistake of having the wrong thoughts. That was a different mistake. This is a mistake on top of a mistake. If the wrong thoughts were had, the carbon is invalid, and then a coin, maybe the same coin, maybe a different coin, put it on top of the Mizbeach instead of...
Yeah, right, yeah. Right. So if it had been taken off, it would draw attention to the fact that somebody messed up.
Yeah.
And we don't see that happening.
Right, that's true.
Do we know situations, Gemara, that...
Yeah. This was, you know, I mean, I can't say it happened every day, but it happened. Yeah.
Well, what if all those coins bought the position?
You're talking about Kohen Gadol in the second Beis HaMikdash. The Gemara says that there were many, many, many Kohen Gadol. Unfortunately, they all died.
Why would anybody pay for that?
Yeah, you see what to get to go into the Kodesh HaKadosh.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.